Hello and welcome to the Spooky Chris Podcast. My name is Chris Ringler. I am your aforementioned Spooky Chris. Thanks for joining me today. It is an honor to be able to speak with today's guest. Glenn Birdsall is an author, a poet, artist, musician with a long history of work in the arts community in Flint, Michigan. He has been involved with the Flint Horror Convention, which became the Flint Horror Collective. He was involved in an arts organization in Flint called the Greater Flint Creative Alliance. He is the author of multiple books and has collaborated on books before, and he is in the two editions of the Battle Flag protest books that some friends and I put together, and he is in both of those. And it is a thrill to speak to him today, and I invite you to stay tuned and listen. Thank you for joining me, Mr. Glenn Birdsall. How are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
I am fine. It's lovely to have you. It's lovely to see you. This is a rare in-person conversation I get to have. All mine are
they usually Zoom?
Yeah.
Really?
I mean, because the people I'm talking to. So, I mean,
yeah, I could have Zoomed.
I mean,
if you wanted.
I've told you who the people. Well, I'll. Yeah. No, I've been talking to people like for some reason.
Yeah.
I got on the radar of publicists, and like so, people that were like putting new books out and stuff were like, "Oh, hey, they want to be on your podcast." It's like, okay.
All right.
Like I had anyways. I'm like I'm gonna diverge too far off the path already, but yes.
But, so. I mean, we don't need a path, man. The whole world's a path for us.
It's not. It's really not. There's wolves.
It kind of is.
There's wolves off the path. I don't want to get bitten.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, the year is 1972. It's a Thursday.
Yes.
There are pants on the. Not
so I'm in Flushing at that point.
I wasn't wearing pants.
Actually, I wasn't far from where you live now.
What do pants have to do with that?
I don't know.
This is in case you want to write. If you want to like write a note to yourself.
All right.
I don't know. But... Are you ready?
Yeah.
Let's kick it. Who was the first poet you fell in love with?
First poet I fell in love with. Interesting question.
Because you are, because I mean, and I we'll get into, but you are among many other things. You are a poet, so a writer of poems. So yeah,
who's, I write of the poems.
So
and I.
The rhyming of words.
And I think I do that because I'm more interested in, like, the surreal and the metaphor than just straightforward writing. And then now answering your question, I think the first ones that I fell in love with were songwriters.
Oh, okay.
To be honest, you know, to be fair, it's... You know, as a little kid, I'm listening to all these records, and so that's probably where it really first started. But then, you know, as you're growing up, you know, I got caught up with, you know, being really little, you loved Shel Silverstein right away. He was, you know, it taps into how kids think. So there was that, of course. And then, you know, as I got older, it grew into people like in high school, I really liked a guy named Walter Delamere, which I think I liked it more. It was really cool poetry, and I think I found some of it in my mother's Lovecraft books.
Oh.
Yeah. And I don't think he was a Lovecraft writer, but I think he kept getting thrown into a few of those books. But I also like the idea that Walter Delamere translates as Walter of the Ocean or the Sea.
Oh.
So it's like a French translation of like Walter of the Sea.
So he was secretly one of the Innsmouth people.
He was a pirate or an Innsmouth person.
Oh, fair.
You know, and then like later on it turns into things like Saul Williams and Langston Hughes, of course. James Baldwin, all of that.
Taylor Swift. Our great modern poet.
All great lyricists, you know. definitely David Bowie, because he always like walked that line with surrealism. Most of the songs, you're still like, I'm not quite sure what this song means, and that's fine. But yeah, that.
Okay, right on. Why? What? For you, what makes songwriting and poetry so powerful?
I mean, some of it has to do with how you can find a lot of different ways to go down the same road. It's kind of like, I remember writing a poem once for our writer's circle way back when, and it sounded as though it was about a lonely person. And then I pointed out at a certain point with one of our friends, Haley, that it was actually about a goldfish in a fishbowl. And she was like, I never saw that. And she was like, that's so cool. So there's definitely, you know, ways to get multiple ideas onto the page. So I'm kind of attracted to that. Both poetry and songwriting does that. Yeah.
Right on. Who's a poet you think everybody should be familiar with or more familiar with?
Oh my
gosh. Or even if you someone you wish more people would be familiar with.
Wow. Okay. Well, you know, I think I would really want people to be more familiar with a lot of the artists downtown, whether they're songwriters or visual.
So yeah, artists. Downtown, the downtown Flint area.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think that people have to be published to be great poets. I think one of the things that, like, you know, publishing ends up being kind of like the final act, but it's kind of like the writing and the sharing of it. That's the creative act. And that's more interesting to me. If you're focused on the final while you're working on it, I feel like it's a hindrance to that. Your question, though, was who should other people really be interested in? There's so many good downtown writers, right? I mean, there's... you're not going to like this, but yourself.
But yeah.
I knew you wouldn't like that. There's Paul. Paul Canellis. There's so many. And it's the wide range of the writers. You know, there's fiction. There's poets. There's songwriters. There's essayists. Jessica's a great writer.
Jessica Revolt, who's in our second Battle Flag book.
Yep. There's, I mean, Nick Custer's a good poet. He's a really, really good poet. It's interesting because the downtown scene, some of the more popular ones are not really the better ones. And that's a good answer for this. A lot of the ones that people talk about a lot in downtown, are not nearly, they don't have the same creativity over and over again that some of the others do that you don't really hear about. And I think that's because they work on their art in a certain manner. They don't try new different ways. And I think once you do that, you start to anticipate what's going to happen in their next poem or their next book or even in their next line. That can happen often. And then, like, other ones, the great songwriters, There's Alex Turner from Arctic Monkeys, great poet. Robert Smith of The Cure. Even his their new, you know, his newest stuff sounds great. Great poetry. I don't know that Saul Williams is as popular in the zeitgeist as I think he is, so he would be one. A lot of people probably don't know who he is. I'd be surprised at that, but I think that's just the way poetry is. I think poetry is one of those art forms that it's not the common art form anymore.
Well, it's interesting, and I kind of guessed you'd say Saul Williams. It's interesting because he's also a musician.
Oh, that's true.
And it's
but when I knew him, he was a poet before that.
Yes, but it's interesting because, like, the kind of at the dawn of hip hop and all of that, is it was street poetry. It was very much, it was much, you know, more than it is today. Much like older rock was more kind of poetic and very, very, very minimalistic and more poetic than it is now, and not storytelling necessarily.
Yeah. And it was literally the other punk rock, you know, the same way that the punk rock lyrics are pretty minimalistic and they're straightforward. Hip-hop's incredibly punk rock.
Well, talking about street life and growing up a lot of times poor and growing up, you know, kind of in the inner city. And
punk rock kids, you know, they grew up to pick up their parents' acoustic guitars, and their parents were usually like Woodstock hippies. So they were like, well, we're going to do something completely different with these old beat up acoustic guitars and their parents' instruments. But in hip hop, they had their parents' record collections. So they're trying to recreate it on the turntables because there aren't a lot of like musical instruments in the cities at the time, because they also took the music out of schools as well. So the dawning of hip hop coincides really in a cool way with punk rock. And we went way off topic.
That's fine. that is completely fine. When did you start writing?
I started writing probably in late junior high, but it was pretty terrible. It started getting good at the end of high school. And so I had a after-school class because I wasn't a good student. I was a terrible student. I was, I think I was around a D average. So I had to go to night school while going to high school. So I'd go back to school about 3 hours later. And I had a English class because I had to make up that credit. And lo and behold, in the English class was this really, really tall, weird guy, Paul Kanellis.
Oh, hilarious.
So that's where I met him, was at night school at Carmen Ainsworth. I lived like really close, so I would like just walk to school. And at the time, he was so obsessed with like The Doors and a band called White Lion, a big hair band. So he kept like reading me like White Lion lyrics.
The one that was
hilarious was something about children in a park. Do you remember this as a ballad?
No. I mean, I remember they had, like I say, like a hit or something, but I can't remember what it was.
It was that.
Children in a park.
It was incredible.
They're in a park.
But I had written something in that class about a kid living in his home, and there was like the ceiling paint was kind of like was flaking, so it looked like clouds. And it was about him trying to make the best out of the world that he had at the time. They made me read in front of the class. Paul loved it. The teacher loved it. And it did motivate me to then write more. So there was that.
Cool. comes to the hard hitting stuff.
Oh my gosh. Let me put my helmet on.
What makes your what sets your writing apart from other writers, other poets?
I don't know if there is anything that does. But however, lots of people have said that there is a style. I don't see it. I honestly don't. I will say it's kind of like, do you know the theory of Yohari's window? Mm-mm. So Yohari's window is this, so it's like a four boxes, right? And there's like the things you know that you can see is in one box, and you know the next box is something else. But the box that's important in it is this part of this theory, which is a psychological, sociological theory, is that there's things about you that you don't know until someone points out to you. And the physical metaphor used is like, oh, you went to the park, you sat on a bench, you have bubble gum on your butt. You're not going to know about it until someone goes, hey, you've got bubble gum on your butt. And in doing that, what your question was, what kind of...
What sets your apart from others.
Right. And I never noticed it until one day at, again, Writer's Circle. This will come up over and over again in this. You had written a Glenn poem. And I was like, damn it, I do have a style. And I never noticed it until you read this thing. You're like, I wrote one that sounds like you. And I was like, no, you didn't.
I remember writing one like someone that was in the group with us, Ryan Bellows. I remember that.
Yeah. And so clearly I did have a style back then. I try not to, though, because, you know, out of all my friends that do write books, I write way less than you, Paul, Dave, a lot of the others. And it's probably because, like, I sit and I poke at these things for so long. My exercise space is Facebook. So I'll write something on there. And then when a year comes around and it's in my memories, and if I look and if it's there, I'll open it up, re-edit it, repost the new edit version, and then wait another year. So like sometimes these things are like taking a long time to like edit over and over and over again until I feel like they're good. There's probably a good poetry book sitting in there at the moment. If I actually delved in. So there's that. And I think part of that too is also like I don't like the idea of like retreading how I do it. I don't know if this is going to make a lot of sense, but I want to try writing differently each time because I'm trying to be open to new inspiration. And I feel like when you get stuck in a rut and you're doing things like it's your comfortable way of doing it, it comes out in your art often. So I work really hard to not do that. But I also think, like I'm pointing out, I think it hinders how much I put out. So there's a give and take, right? Like if I just worked on the blueprints of how I normally do it over and over again, I could have had maybe four more books by now. Or if I'm like you and Paul, 10 more books by now. But I think it's just how I work comes out maybe in my writing. Again, I do think that there's ideas that I retread over and over again. And I retread a lot of ideas because, for me, I think writing, and I think this is true with a lot of artists, whether they see it or not, and I'm not saying every artist, of course, but I think a lot, is you're working on it to heal yourself. I think that, like, a lot of times what we're working on or what we're writing or what we're painting or the movie that we're making, in a way, it's healing things that have been there since our foundational, when we're brought up, you know, those foundational years. And I think, like, for most artists, whether it's conscious or not, I think that's why they're doing it. So that, you'll see themes come up in mine over and over again, because I think I'm retreading and trying to fix or heal those things that happened when you were a kid.
That's interesting.
So there's that.
Interesting. Yeah, I would, from the outside looking in, you approach poetry as if you're writing songs.
Yes.
Like, it's you are very methodical and very, like, you there is a rhythm to you, how you write, and there is a, it is very much akin to writing a song.
Right, right. I try not to use complete rhyme schemes, although, you know, how songs would probably do that more often. And part of that is because I took to heart something that Jack White said once about if there's too much rhythm in it, especially in like writing poetry, you'll get lost in the rhythm and you're not listening to the idea that's in the poem. So the idea is way more important to me than this rhythm of, like, let's say the rhyme schemes like AABC, AABC. I'm not going to do that because I feel like at some point you're just going to hear that rhyme over and over again. So I came up with, and I used to call it, dropping a rusty tricycle. So there'd be a line, like, if I'm doing it too much in a poem, I put in a line that's so incredibly hard for me to, like, read, if it's especially at an open mic, that it makes me stop and, like, kind of put out this weird clunky line.
Octothorpe.
So that you, octothorpe is a good example, which is a word that I think I sort of made up. Octothorping. Because octothorpe is a word.
Yeah.
But I called it octothorping as in numbering something. And, I feel like it works. It kind of, it brings the reader, or if you're reading it at an open mic, the listener. It brings them back to, like, what you're talking about. Because, again, you get lost in the rhythm. And I'm not Gloria Estefan.
That's what you think. Before we change gears, what do you think? this is a bigger question for you. What do you think the role of the writer or poet is in turbulent times?
Wow, that's a really, really cool question. I think the writer in turbulent times is there to hold a mirror up to everyone. And that's a hard place to be, because you're holding it up to, I mean, if we're talking about turbulent times in that, the book that we just made, I think in this idea of turbulent times, there's two sides to this coin. So you're trying to hold up a mirror that both sides understand. Very hard to do. I think in that case, with our Battle Flag book, I think most of the writers did a better job of that than I did. My stuff was a little bit too preachy, I feel like. I think that's what you're trying to do, is you're trying to hold up that mirror. And often there isn't two sides. And, you know, turbulent times can be about a revolution. You know, there's lots of writers in Russia or the Czech Republic that wrote stuff that reflected those turbulent times, right? There's great poetry right now coming out of South America, and I think that's based on turbulent times with getting rid of the natural forests. So, and you'll read it in there. You'll see it over and over again. In the horror world, there also, in the same vein, there's a look back at folk horror. Because I think, again, we're worried about the planet. There's this horror about, like, oh, what are we doing to the planet? And you're seeing it now in, like, a lot of horror movies as well, from Ritual to all kinds of stuff. But folk horror is kind of making a comeback, both in horror and sci-fi, with the I can't remember his name. Basically, the guy that wrote Annihilation.
That's what I was thinking, is Annihilation. Stuff.
Yeah, that guy.
I wonder, just to poke in, I wonder if the modern re-interest in it is a rejection of modern real horror and a desire to go back to the supernatural and to, like, the kind of cosmic and the things that, like, I'd rather be afraid of a giant, like, bear god coming after me than, right, like, a man with a knife or, like, the police state or, like, stuff that I can read a paper. It's like, because we crawled, yeah, back to that after a while because, like, it was just life got, it was like we can't ignore how real life has gotten.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And there's also the idea of, like, sometimes you bring back horror because it's the opposite of the horror that's happening too.
Yeah.
So you also have, like, AI and stuff, which is the complete opposite of what folk horror is.
Yeah.
You think about,
yeah,
it. But there's probably analogies in there that are similar. You know, AI in a way is like a bacteria or a virus. You know, it is like a giant group of mushrooms that are taking over when you think about it. So technology and nature are not so different in that sort of way.
AI and technology will become the new folk horror in that we are, I mean, and it's funny to say this, but I think it's true. We are creating the new god.
Yes.
Because we are at the birth. There will be we're not going to say Christianity, so there's not going to be like a digital Jesus, but like we will see where people will get, fingers crossed we get that far, a generation or two ahead, where people like look to AI like AI knows all.
Absolutely.
AI sees all. Like AI is all. Like, so it's like that's who you turn to. Like you pray to AI, whatever, you know, at that point, if it's unified, if it's whatever that unified AI is called, you go to it and like, you know, what do I make for dinner? What do I want to be when I grow,
right,
up? Is my, you know, spouse cheating? Like you, that is who you turn to. You don't turn to a priest. You turn to, and it would be, it's interesting because you, instead of going through a priest, you are going to God and God is answering.
Right, right. But I mean, and I think one of the things that's interesting about that too is that AI in of itself, its job is to find the best answer that most people are going to like. So it's always going to use the middle ground. So in a sense, we never really will see AI be as creative as a human can be because its program is to get as big of an audience as possible. And all of the great art is not about you trying to make an end product that everyone's going to like. If that's what your art is, you've made a product. You haven't made art. Art is for you. So you have to be comfortable with it in the end. And once you're comfortable with it, then of course it could become a product because then you're publishing it. But that's the product side. And hopefully you're not thinking of the product side while you're making it. During that creative process, one of the things you should know is like, you need to just be open to wherever the creative process is taking you, right? So like you go, well, I think my story was this, but I just saw that. So maybe this needs to now turn towards that. And the creative process and whether it's art or product, it can hinder what you're working on. Like, and you probably won't love it as much if you end up making product in the end.
No, for sure. Absolutely. And like I said, we're changing gears. So let's talk about your experience working in the Flint art scene. When did you get involved in the Flint art scene?
I mean,
casually or seriously, it doesn't matter.
Okay. Casually or seriously, in the Flint art scene. So we're going to talk about Flint, like downtown Flint.
Yeah.
Okay. I grew up technically in Flint Township. As a little kid, I was in Flushing.
I mean, but you and I were both, I mean, involved in that, right, scene. Like, and we both kind of came to it.
Right, and that's why I'm going to talk about in a way that I hope you'll interject as well. Because in a way, the Flint art scene, when I was part of it, you were also part of it. And with the Creative Lines by itself, you were there 3 or 4 meetings before I was even part of it.
Was I?
Yeah. Huh. Because you had said, you should do this. You know, you were like, we were both at U of M Flint at the time. We had taken a lot of classes together. And what's weird is, let's say a quarter of our classes we were both in those classes together. We almost never were like, hey, are you going to take this? Because I'll take it too. We just ended up in the same classes over and over and over again. The Bible in English was a hilarious one. You did so well in it, and I worked my ass off, and I barely passed.
And I didn't take a note.
You didn't take a note. So you had mentioned the Creative Alliance, and there was a writer's circle. And at that time, it was in the basement of a bookstore on Saginaw. This bookstore then moved over to Buckham.
Yeah, that's when
Alley, like, later on.
Yeah, that's right. I was working there. Yeah.
But when we went there, it was down by Paul's Pipe Shop.
Yep.
Down in that area. And yeah, it was great. There was only 4 or 5 regulars at the time.
Yeah, I remember it would balloon up. It was big at first, and then everybody kind of scuttered away, and then it would balloon up once in a while because people would bring guests, right, or whatever. But yeah, there was like a core of 4 or 5.
But when we started doing that together, it felt like the art scene downtown had really exploded. And then there's a second wave of that, probably 5 to 6 years later, which I think would be the Guerrilla Art Show. But pre the Guerrilla Art Show, we were organizing art shows at Buckham Gallery, at empty buildings downtown. We were in the, me and you did art shows at what later would become Wise Guys, and we also did a few over in what later would be the Flint Journal offices, when it was like just an empty space. And then we did a lot with the Creative Alliance, both at GFAC and again Buckham. And they weren't all writing, some of them were visual. We weren't really part of the music shows with the Creative Alliance, but they needed the writers to wrangle musicians because they were like cats. They would just scatter, and you were like, no, you guys, you got to set up all the equipment and do this and do that. And
well, and part of the fun of that group was that everybody, well, the idea was that everybody kind of,
pitched in.
Yeah. Everybody, it was like that for a little bit. And then it kind of got more into like the people that were reliable would be the ones that would pitch in and kind of set up and tear down and clean up and everything. And then people would come and go.
And again, the writers group were a bunch of squares. So we were really good at that. We were organized and we were there to get a lot of those things done. But we started doing all kinds of really cool shows. And a lot of them were like mixed art shows.
So that's what I was thinking is Beauty and the Beat with performer and musician Tune Dale Anron.
Right.
Like, which is interesting because, you know, they got really kind of blew up and came from that scene.
Right. And then we were doing a show called Voices for a while, which was like visual art mixed with a writer.
Yeah.
And what was cool about that was when I started thinking about it, I wanted it to be as even between the two artists. So it was like this idea of like any type of writer and then any type of visual artist would get together and work on something. And the idea was that the visual artist would give the writer something, and then the writer would write on it. And then the writer would give the visual artist something, and then they would create something visual, whether it's a photo or a painting or whatnot. Even a stuffed animal. That was actually one at one point.
Fun.
That was Steph Bills.
Oh, okay.
Had done creatures for
That's fun.
And then the third piece of art was the writer would sit with the visual artist, and they would talk about something, and then they would find common ground and create one just out of both their thoughts together. And it made it a really cool art show that I think we did 5 or 6 of those.
You were
things.
Doing them. I mean, you guys were still doing them after I left. So, like, you did at least one more.
There's
or two.
Quite a few. Yeah.
And
we made books out of some of those.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, to kind of catch folks up, I've talked about the Creative Alliance in blogos and stuff, but like, so it was essentially a group of, it started with a group of musicians that were getting together to kind of pool their resources to book gigs and to kind of support one another. And in so doing, a bunch of other folks that were interested in the arts and the art stuff started going to those meetings, and it kind of became a thing. And it was, the cool part was that there was, it organically pulled together all of these, you know, musicians and artists and writers and these people together in under one banner. And for several years, like, you know, and people would get like, 'cause I'm thinking, you know, people would, if they had an idea, like, oh, I have this idea for a cool show, and they would get like, okay, cool. And if it was, you know, everybody kind of talk about it, I'm like, okay, cool, let's do this cool show. And somebody would kind of take lead on it, and the group kind of brought in outside elements like this Beauty and the Beat, which was music and fashion. It was you know, this, and outside of the music, this completely out of the scope of stuff we were doing, but it was cool because it was a kind of a challenge to everybody, and it was a neat event that stretched what the group did. You know, we would get into ruts and kind of just do the same kind of, like, a lot of the members were in kind of jam bands, and so we kind of used to do jam band shows, or, you know, like, oh, we're just gonna have people read a poem or something. Like, so we get in ruts, which was fine, but, like, you know, the times that we could kind of stretch ourselves was cool. Like, we did the graffiti show that kind of blew up in our face.
Yeah. But the graffiti show was a huge mistake, because it was, one, Buckham let us do graffiti on the wall.
Yeah,
would cover it.
Yeah, it's a downtown art gallery that's since moved, but they would close down in the summer because they didn't have air.
Right.
And so we would book dates in there during the summer, you know, like a show, because it was, I mean, it would literally get towards 100 because it was so hot.
Oh, yeah.
And so they didn't want to have gallery shows. So we would be like, cool, we're just going to go in and do our show. And they gave us this space. And they're like, cool, whatever you do, you have to, like, basically paint back to white. Like, that's all we're asking.
And some of the colors or the paint that they were using, we were on, like, our 7th or 8th coat.
Yeah,
they cover some of this art
way above and beyond what they should have been done.
Yeah.
And then only a handful of us wanted to repaint.
Right. But what that taught me, though, was that the following year, I knew the person that was running that gallery, and they gave me one of the summer months to do a show. And I did a show called Ghost Art, where I just had art projected onto the wall. So you could use a slide projector or an overhead projector or a movie projector. And whatever you create, you're just going to project onto the wall. One, because of the painting, taught me, like, oh, I'm never going to put anything on the wall again, including poking holes in the wall. I don't even want to cover those. But it was a cool art show. And it was this idea of, like, the art was projected, so, like, people could literally just walk in front of the art, in fact, and the art's projected onto them. Or, and I remember, like, Courtney Simpson and Marilyn Chapman having art at that. And I think Dominic Murphy.
Okay. DJ Dom.
Yeah. So those are some of the artists that I remember at that show. But I think there were lots of others. There must have been. But again, it was that idea of, like, learning from that mistake.
Now, how have you seen kind of the and to me, Flint is a perfect example of kind of some of these conversations, because it's a city that's, I mean, it's a historic city, and it's a city that's, it's not small, but it's small enough you can kind of have impactful shows and stuff, and you can kind of, you can measure things more than like a Chicago or New York or Detroit, where it's, there's so many people working in so many different, like different corners, you can't really keep an eye on it.
Right.
So how have you seen kind of the art scene in Flint change over the years? From, I mean, when you think of it, when you and I both moved to downtown Flint, like the building we were in was the front of the door was blocked off and you couldn't access the front of the building. And
right.
No one really came downtown a whole lot to when we were involved in art, like the art walk really blew up and more people came down and got involved and kind of really changed things.
Well, I think with that story, that is where you go back to the Guerrilla Art Show. So at one time, when you went to Art Walk, it was GFAC, Buckham Gallery, I think one of the churches, and there was this art gallery in the Patterson Building.
Left end gallery?
Yeah, right? You remember that?
Yeah.
And sometimes there would be something at Churchill's. But that was not as often as it is now.
Yeah.
Like once in a blue moon. And then we did that Guerrilla Art Show.
Which it was essentially, so basically the building we lived in, the first floor was unoccupied, and the guy who owns that building was one of the foundational people who kind of got the indie music scene going in Flint and kind of started clubs and stuff there.
Right.
And we were able to talk him into letting us do art shows in the building, kind of on the down low. And so between Glenn and I and some other people we know a lot of artists.
A lot. Especially back then. It was crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. So we were able to pull in artists from Detroit and, all around our region to do this art show in an unconventional space, ergo a guerrilla art show.
Right.
And just kind of offer people like kind of an art spectacle. And I mean, we had, you know, a DJ at one of them and perform, you know, music performers and stuff.
Yeah. And the very first show, one of the things I remember doing was taking my little tiny CD stereo up to the roof and putting it up there and then putting in. Who knows what I played? I'm sure it was like
David Bowie,
Duran Duran, or I'm almost positive it was Duran Duran and Bowie and some other things like that. So we were playing that on there, and then like everybody that was walking along from GFAC to get to Buckham would hear that and go, "What's going on across the street at across Saginaw?"
Yeah, because it was a bunch of us with tables set up,
yeah,
and nothing else, and it was very, very like. Yeah, so yeah. Yeah.
We were doing all these things to like get people to walk over to it. And that was one of them, was like, let's just play some music and they'll look over and see if something's happening.
And it was interesting because that building at the time, there's kind of a display windows that kind of go around the entrance. And at the time, there was no glass in there. It was just like this open space. And people would come, and we would too, like come and just sit in the window space during the art walk and stuff. So that was part of what... Yeah. People would come, and it was kind of a place, like we had Busker, one of them, and like people would come and sit.
Yeah.
And you see people sitting and like, well, what's going on here? And they would come in that way.
Which I think one of the first Buskers was Corey Plank.
Yeah, yep.
Who's literally playing Churchill's tomorrow.
Oh.
He's up visiting, like family.
I was going to say, wow.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's going to be at Churchill's tomorrow. And he was one of the first Buskers at it.
That's cool. He's one of the founders of Creative Alliance.
Like, yes.
It's not... He's one of the
I think
two or three. Yeah,
the founder.
He's like one of the.
He's the one. But yeah, it was a really cool show, and I remember Greg coming over.
the person that oversees the Great Flint Arts Council.
Yes, and he walked over and he came in and he saw what we were doing, and there was like his moment of annoyance turned to complete joy when he walked in. Like, he didn't look happy, and then he suddenly saw what was going on. He was like, oh, all right. I think maybe someone complained about the music or something. Who knows? But, man, he was really into it. And
they were protective of the art walk at the time because like, the establishment didn't want a bunch of, like, you know...
All these...
outsiders coming and crashing the party.
All these gorillas.
Yeah.
So, which is another whole story that we won't... But and he loved it, and then he started promoting us.
Yeah.
And then after that, maybe a year or two, maybe 2 years later, you started seeing it happen all up and down.
Yeah.
The downtown area. So, I mean, that's one of the main reasons, one of the main, I think that's one of the biggest changes for downtown art. Now, I will say that the art from the younger people that are doing it now seems way more professional. I think it's because there's a lot of, you can do almost anything on your own now. Yeah. You know, technology and their access to art equipment or art supplies is all over. It's easy for them to do.
And so much, I think so much too, it helps because people can kind of like show work. Like when, you know, when we were getting involved, like people weren't really posting. I mean, I can't, not art from our like circles, like their art necessarily online a whole lot.
Right.
Like, cause it was before, it was pre-Facebook. So yeah. It would have been MySpace. So, you know, you kind of, every one of the gallery shows, and now you can have, a free website or your social media, and you're posting right. stuff, and you can sell that way. I mean, it's funny. Yeah. We'd mentioned an artist, you know, before we went on air, and there's the artists that have popped up since you and I had gotten started who went from street artists and who are making quite a bit of money doing, you know, street style art now. They are not right. on the street, but they're doing that style of art, the lo-fi art. And they make very good money at it. And yeah. it's the walls really came down with Creative Alliance, with our shows, with Red Ink, this big
Definitely.
Gallery that came from San Francisco that set up shop in Flint for a little while, and then it became an independent organization locally. That opened door, because there were more places for these independent artists to show, and they didn't have to kind of kowtow to what the gallery culture wanted them to be, and they kind of were able to embrace themselves.
Yeah, I mean, one of the ones that I remember as a kid coming through was Tara Lockhart. So she was this little kid, and she was just going to, you know, coming to the shows, and she played one of our shows as a musician at the Gorilla shows. But now she does like really professional looking art shows at Buckham. So I mean, that's one of those people that, you know. And back when we were doing it, I also remember a lot of the painters, they were using house paint at times because, like, that's all they had.
Yeah.
There was, at when we were doing it, there was this idea of, like, use whatever you can. I'm not quite sure that's as true as it was then.
I mean, to some artists, like, oh gosh! Like, so we have artists, but that do that. That
yeah, yeah.
There is a kind of a style of art that is like the lost and found. But you're right. It's not yeah. as it's now. It's art is. It seems like it's more in a digital space and
right.
not in as much. Doesn't seem like as much of a tactile space.
Yeah, unless you get to someone like a Ryan Gregory.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of. I blanked on his name, but yeah, Ryan Gregory, who's a local artist who just. Yeah, my old, he's the one that helped me score my movies and had, I snatched some of that for the old theme for the podcast. So, like, just he would take old kids' toys he'd find and like, reconfigure them to work with other things and then just create a whole Frankenstein, like, thing. And so it's just kind of a weird kind of a genius that is just like, he's... Like, it's a specific kind of genius that sees how to do that. And it's like, okay.
Yeah.
Like, I don't see it. How important is it for a city, especially a city like Flint, to have a thriving art scene?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, I can't think of anything. Well, I mean, it's a silly statement to say. I can't think of anything more important, right? Because you'd be like, well... You know, hospitals and health and education. But I think for a city like Flint, and I think this is super important, is the art scene is therapy for both the artists and the people coming to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
Through music, through the visual arts, through the writing, through all kinds of arts, you know, everything that we're creating, is tapping into therapy for us. It's part of our psychology. It's helping us stay healthy, especially in a community like Flint, where there's a lot of things that don't work out for us. State government has never been very good with us.
Local government.
local government, federal government.
Which it's funny because I always and just parenthetically laugh because Flint and Michigan tried out some of the stuff that went. The country was a little behind Flint in the state of Michigan with like Trump in that like Flint had their rich guy mayor who was going to run the city like a business and he was a businessman and oh gosh yeah and he was a crook and he would just do crooked things and he was terrible and then the state had Snyder who was like I'm going to run the state like a business because I ran Gateway into the ground and I'm a great businessman. Well, he poorly ran the state, so poorly we had a water crisis. And like, so it's funny to me that it's
so I think it's that. I think it's a collective, it's almost like a collective therapy, right? So without it, look, Flint's incredibly resilient. And it's, I can't think of a city or its people that have more heart than Flint. Probably the reason why I don't have plans to leave is because there isn't any place like this. No place has as much soul as Flint. And the art scene is important to keep that soul healthy. Yeah.
Right on. You were kind of one of the key people in the creation of the Flint Horror Con / Collective. Tell me about that.
Well, I don't think I was one of the... I think there was three people pre-me, right?
There was four.
Right.
It was
right.
You, me. Well, it was you, me. Five, I guess.
Right.
Justin, Steve, and then...
Gary?
Gary. Yeah.
Okay. So I think part of it was that me and you had done a gazillion shows by then. And we did a lot of shows extremely successfully. And what I mean by that is the show opened, people came, they had a good time, they left. I don't mean that they made money. I don't mean that they even remember it. Who knows who remembers what, right?
Yeah.
But we got in, we made it happen, we could leave.
Yeah.
And I think part of that was, and I'm going back by what the conversations we had way back then, was this idea that I was good at understanding the spaces. Like, this is how much this is how many people you can fit in here. These are where the plugs are because you're going to have people that need, you know, monitors or this or that or the other.
Yeah, you're a space savant.
I was a space savant. And, you know, I think that, especially with it being at the, it started at the Masonic.
Yeah, the downtown Flint Masonic Temple.
Which you'd think would be an amazing space, but it's a confusing space, right?
Yeah. Just... I mean, it's an outdated space that was not suited for what we needed it to be.
Right. Hard to get vendors just in and out of the building.
Yeah.
It's not set up for lots of people to go in and out of.
A lot of stairs that we had Green Goblin booked for the truck he was booked to come until Glenn was like, well, wait, let's measure the door and see if he can get in it, and he couldn't. And like, well, we can't even. And there was a middle railing where he couldn't even get up to it, like with what he has. And the only way to look for, and it was always a stressor. They had an old elevator.
Yes.
That was very rickety, and there was a handicapped lift, like a literal lift that people in wheelchairs could use, and vendors were using that to bring in hundreds of pounds of comics and all this stuff, and it was very unnerving because we were like, oh, if something goes wrong with that thing, it's on us to figure out how to pay him for fixing it.
Absolutely.
So it was very scary.
And it was weird, too, in that you couldn't tell people... movies are on the second floor. You had to tell people, movies are on the red floor.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't really have second or third floors, yep, because there's lobby, staggered.
Yeah, red floor, blue floor, and then ante, or like the whatever the, I forget the weird.
Very
John,
strange,
John Benjamin's
right?
floor.
But I think what was cool about it was like the guests, like the celebrity guests we had come in, they ended up liking, you know, the building and having usually a pretty good time. And I feel like it was an incredible success. You know, at least the first 4 or 5 were really great.
I mean, they all were. They were never successful financially.
Sure.
But I think they were successful organically in that, like, I don't think any of us, if we were honest with ourselves, and I don't think any of the guests would say, like, oh, this is a failure. It was just always frustrating because we would charge like $10 to get in. Like, we'd charge very little money to get in as part of our ethos.
Well,
like,
the table fees were ridiculously low.
Yeah. So we tried, because, you know, part of what we stood for is to keep the prices down and keep it, because we understood that we were in a blue collar city and didn't want to have it too expensive, because the whole point would, I mean, in my mind, is you want volume more than just like the, it's like, cool, you got 40 people paying $20 to get in. I'd rather have, like, you know.
Yeah.
Like, we'd rather 100 people paying $5, right. Yeah, like, so we never really were, we made enough to keep going for a little while, but yeah, it was just, it's those, I think, and especially nowadays, I think it's so easy to underestimate the cost. I mean, I can't imagine right now with getting people around and stuff. Like, we were lucky because the group we had and we ended up with, like, people knew people. So we were calling them favors and like, okay, cool. If you can get me out there, I will do your show. Like, just pay for me to get out to you and to put me in a hotel for a minute and, like, you know, maybe feed me.
Yeah. We had, the Christine car.
Yeah.
We had Pazuzu, Eileen Dietz.
Yeah.
We had, people from Dawn of the Dead and Night of the Living Dead.
Daniel Roebuck.
People from Evil Dead.
Oh, my gosh.
Quite a few.
Why am I thinking? Your guy, and I can't think of his darn name, from Martin.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't think.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't think
of. Yeah, but we had just really, like, you know, Tom Sullivan. This, like, really interesting.
Yeah.
Cool. Like, you know, it's. Our idea for the convention was, like, we knew we couldn't afford, because it was funny, because we had a guy that was part of our group that was like pie in the sky, like, I can get us to so and so and this and that, and he would find it, and it was like, and he could once in a while get his foot kind of in the door, but it was always still the money's money,
yeah,
and we just didn't have any, and so, you know, we kind of changed our attention to, like, let's not go after the big names, which it's, you know, kind of screws you now, especially, but, like, people want, and I understand it, but people want the big stars. They want the big, because they want the autograph and they want the big stuff.
Sure.
But we were like, we like the kind of the people in the trenches that are like the character actors and the people behind the scenes and the people that, like, you know who they are.
Right.
But their name may not be the star of the show per se, but you know who they are and they're beloved and they're great at what they do.
Ken Sagos.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah. You know, we had Ari Lehman, who was the quote-unquote first Jason, and, like, huge personality, and he played a show for us, like he did a concert for us,
right?
Kevin Hendrick, he was going to do a show.
Oh, that's right.
He was going to play with him, like, he was going to do an acoustic set, and it was just where we were supposed to play. We were supposed to have the show got moved, and it got joined with a punk show, and the punk bands were super obnoxious and. Just, it wasn't a good, and it was a at a bar that wasn't a good scene, and it was not like, our, like, first Jason band, great, like, they were great, like,
yeah.
they play bars and stuff, they're used to that vibe. Ken Ben Hendrick, like, brought his acoustic guitar, not his scene
at all,
kind of put his guitar down, like, I'm good,
yeah,
like, so what was it like putting on these shows? I mean, you kind of got into it a little bit, but what was it like for you?
It was great. I mean, you know, I was mostly organizing it and then making sure everything was working on the day. I didn't get to enjoy it as much as some of our other counterparts in the Flint Horror Collective. I did not get to enjoy it as much as some of them, because I was busy doing things, but it was great. It was great. And I mean, to be fair, a lot of the way I look at doing art is I get probably very close to, if not as much, joy out of seeing other people succeed as myself, which is another reason why I may not have put out as many books as I've wanted to, because I get sidetracked with, like, hey, can you help me make this record? Or, hey, can you help me with this idea or that idea? And I'm like, yeah. And I don't feel bad about it, because that, there's so much joy in me watching someone else succeed in creating art. I still have artists that come over to my house over, you know where I am.
Yeah.
And they'll say, can I just come over and work on art? And I'll, like, yeah, I'm listening to records, but sure. And they'll sit down on the floor in my living room and work on their art.
That's fun.
The last one was working on costumes for the Renfest. Yeah, come over. You can do it here. I don't care. And I'm not quite sure why they're not doing it at their house, but yeah, if you want to come over,
maybe the material's haunted and they don't want
to be maybe alone with the ghost. Maybe, but the joy of putting those on was seeing the rest of the group succeed. Yourself, Gary, Jen, everybody else, and then seeing the people coming through and having a good time too. The amount of joy you saw on, like, teenagers' faces when they would run into, like, a Tom Sullivan. Oh my gosh, that's the guy that created the book. You know, the Evil Dead book. Their eyeballs would get so big, and the grins. It was incredible. Yeah, great time.
All right, so we have reached almost the end of the platform. What is a last bit of art advice you would offer people? Like you know, if they're looking for inspiration, or if they're just looking to keep going, what would you say to inspire them?
Well, you know, one of the things that I always find interesting, and in, like, when I'm writing and when other people are talking to me about their writing, is that it starts with detail, right? So they'll go, this was the cool line I heard for this poem. This is the cool line. And I get it. But the whole thing needs to be, you know, at some point the detail will get lost because the whole becomes more important, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing becomes more important. So the detail will at some point get lost in the work. So I think that's one of the things that's important. Another thing is, again, it's this idea of, like, you know, I think there's also this idea of believing that the thing is either too great, or the more common, this is not good enough. My art's not good. It's terrible. And I think both of those also are a distraction. And this idea of, you know, oh, this is perfect, this is the best thing I've ever done, is almost as bad as this thing is garbage. And I think part of that comes from, again, our how we're brought up, the foundation of who we are. When we're little kids, either someone's told you they've put too many of your pictures on the refrigerator, and we're like, these are all great. So you're not seeing, you're seeing the what you're working on as being perfect right out the gate. So therefore, you're not challenging yourself enough, or you don't think it's good enough. And lots of times growing up, we had people in our lives that were like, you can't be a visual artist because your drawings are not very good, or this poem is not that good. It needs all this work. So when you're really young and impressionable, those things either gave you too much confidence or gave you zero confidence. But those things are still with you as an adult. When you're working on art, you're like, you know, I'm not quite sure. And as soon as you start to think that or start to go down that road, question whether it's from those times. Oh, is this me talking to myself back because I heard this when I was a 5-year-old or a 9-year-old or in art class when I was, you know, in the 10th grade? All of that needs to go away because the creative process can't keep tripping over you're not good enough or it's perfect the way it is already. You know, it can't be perfect before you're making it. So I think those are kind of the things that I would suggest to other artists is don't get tripped up by those, by your feelings that were centered back then.
What are you working on now?
What am I working on now?
Probably a harder question than you thought.
Writing songs with the band. And then, of course, you know, I've got the those poetry books that I still need to, like, keep going back to. The 100 Years Later sequel to 1984, I would love to finish. But I feel like I'm going to be working on that forever because, you know, other things will come up. And sometimes the other things aren't other people's work, too. Like, every so often, Paul's like, we need to write a book together. And I'm like, ah. Oh. You write like 4 a year on your own. Why do you need me to help? But I think again, it's that motivation. You know, other people, when they want to work with you, that's a great thing. I think there's magic in collaboration. It makes you see something that you're not seeing, right? So if you're writing with another person, if you're creating music with another person, one of the greatest art forms we know of is making movies. And that is a collaborative as heck piece of art, right? It's just, there's so much going on. And I think collaboration often creates some of the best art because no one vision is part of it. It's an amalgamation of visions. So, you know, who knows, maybe I'll be working on something with somebody, or I'll get back to this 1984 book at some point.
And then last question, how can people track down your books?
You can track down my books by...
tracking you down?
By tracking me down. That's a good one. No, seriously, I do have books at home, and if I'm doing shows in the area, you can always buy books there.
Assume someone's in Pittsburgh.
Right. That's where I'm going to go to next. So if you're in Pittsburgh, you have to drive west towards Michigan. No, I'm just kidding. You can go to Amazon and just look up Glenn Birdsall, B-I-R-D-S-A-L-L. And I think at least half of the books are there. Other than that, you'd have to come find me for a few of the others.
Well, awesome. Thank you so much for making some time. It was great to speak with you, sir.
It was great.
And I will leave it at that. I want to thank author and poet and artist Glenn Birdsall for making some time to come on the podcast. You can find all of his books, or at least most of them, on Amazon.com. And I thank you for listening. You can find all my stuff at SpookyChris.com and all of my books at Amazon as well. And I thank you again, and we'll speak to you soon.